Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Irish Farmers Journal podcast.
Hello, everyone. It's Thursday, the 30th of September, 2021. I'm Stephen Robb, and you're very welcome along to the Irish Farmers Journal tillage podcast. Once again, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague, Andy Doyle, and he's back from some annual leave. And my other colleague, Siobhan Walsh, is actually off on some annual leave this week. In fact, she's busy getting her own crops in. So, Andy, it's just the two of us this week. And as always, we'll take a look around the country to see what has been happening in Ireland's tillage fields. What have you been seeing, Andy?
Stephen, it's good to see the thing being turned over once again. Certainly signs of planting going on. Plenty of signs also of catch crops having been well established early. Some of them, I would say, obviously for fall, or more of them just as catch crops. And I think we're probably going to be getting into the very busy end of planting as and from now. You know, we're virtually in October. There's kind of no negatives in most fields associated with planting now, with the possible exception of people taking significant chances in take-all situations. But it's good to see it, that the year is turning over once again, and it's good to see that we're still enthusiastic about doing it.
Yeah, certainly, you know, based on what happened last year, there probably is that degree of nervousness, or rather just that they're not going to cut out again. So with the weather being so good, with ground conditions being so good, you know, some guys are going probably a little bit earlier than maybe they ought to.
That may be the case, Stephen, but from what I can judge, some of the very early planting, as in barely into the second half of September, that's been pulled back, and that's the bit that's probably causing the greater amount of harm. So if that's being pulled back into the last week in September, then while it mightn't be the best possible practice, it's something that you have to live with by virtue of having big acres to plant and to get the job done on time.
Yeah, and look, there's no doubt about it. Things have changed this week. I mean, there's a notable difference in temperature, and it'll probably take a little while for it to trickle through to the soil. But it is, it's autumnal. The fields are autumnal. But of course, there's many other activities going on in the fields as well. My neck of the woods, there's a fair bit of sowing going on. Indeed, some guys are done. Some of the guys out further west as well are done at this stage. Maize has kicked off in some areas, and by all accounts, yields are damn good. But look, it's still probably on the early side as well. So it's probably too early to call as to what kind of a season it's going to be. And indeed, the same with potatoes. Main crop harvest has commenced in some areas. By all accounts, things are just looking average, so they are. But we'll find out a little bit more about how the potato harvest is going, probably next week or the week after when a lot more guys get into it. Andy, we'll move on and we'll get into it. So last week we had Glanbia announce their 2021 grain prices and Dairy Gold followed suit at the start of this week. What kind of prices have they announced?
Well, Dairy Gold have come out even stronger than Glanbia had done. They're to pay €212 a tonne for barley, €222 euro a ton for wheat, 207 for oats, and 243 for contracted malting barley. They're the cereal prices that they have come out with. Good prices, strong prices, probably justified by the change in international prices that have occurred this week. They're overall, we could say that they're a lot stronger prices on the basis that while they're inclusive of a trading bonus, the trading bonus is only €5 a ton. So realistically, that barley price is 207. We topped up to make it to make it 212 for guys that fulfil the trading requirements. So strong prices, and I think it's in fairness to them, they're doing what they said. They're supporting their tillage farmers in amongst their cooperative activities. So it's good to see it. They've also prices for beans at 255, non-contract beans at 250, and oilseed rape at 535. Those prices, latter prices, are kind of similar to what Glanbia had. But the good prices, they should help those crops to turn into money also.
Yeah, by all accounts, any of the dairy goat suppliers we've been talking to this week are happy, and rightly so. You mentioned there, Andy, that international prices have taken a turn in the right direction again this week. What's been going on?
Yeah, it's almost as if they're plugged into an oscilloscope where you just get this continuous wavelength of prices going up and down. This week, we're kind of looking at supply being a factor in the market again. On the wheat side and on the maize side, we're looking at Europe having maybe an estimated 4.5 million tons lower production than was the case in last week or the week before. And that's obviously changing market sentiment. And also we have milling wheat beginning to have a part to play in the overall scene as well. But we'll talk about that later.
So I guess, do we have any indication, or is anyone even offering forward prices that are worth consideration, I should say?
Yes, Stephen, I have asked that question. And if I can just kind of backtrack ever so slightly on corn prices first, 2 weeks ago, or last Friday, 2 weeks, Matif closed at, I think it was 237.75 a ton. A week later, it was up a tenner. So last Friday, it was up a tenner. And yesterday, it closed at 254 a ton. So it's up almost €20 in the space of a fortnight. And that is kind of reflected in the way all markets are being viewed. If somebody was willing to look and consider forward selling at the moment, wheat's worth about between 215 and 220, and barley about a tenner under that. So, you know, if a lot of people would always have had in their mind that they would consider selling above 190, wheat above 190, 220, 215, they have to be worth a punt in the situation that we have at the moment.
Yeah, it's certainly worth considering a ton to the acre at least. Just you mentioned, I mean, that's a significant rise in the space of 2 weeks on international markets. What was the driver now?
Look, at the main driver in nearly all instances is maize. The 2 weeks ago, there was a forecast of much improved yields for maize, and there was also the difficulties associated with exporting maize from the US because of the infrastructure damage from the storm. And now again, there's an export plant down on the West Coast, which again is affecting the capacity to get product out into the markets. And that's leaving somebody shy somewhere else and having to go for an alternative source of supply. And, you know, all the different things that are going on, they're all just making the market feel uneasy. But, you know, it's still important to say that there is a limit kind of to the top side of where prices can go, because people always have a choice to go in a different direction and select an alternative feed or food. But ultimately, Stephen, ultimately it's driven by maize prices that are still up there around 280, 285 for nearby access, and 255, 260 from kind of September onwards. And, you know, when we get to, from November onwards, when we get to November, who knows, those prices could be back up towards the 280s. And that means that there's a big demand in feed circles for wheat and barley of European origin.
Okay, watch the space. Andy, we'll move on in the interest of time. So earlier this week, on Tuesday night, the Irish Farmers Journal's Justin McCarthy and Pat O'Toole held a leaders' debate in Tullamore Farm between all of the main farm organisations. So the Irish Farmers Association, Irish Creamery Milk Suppliers Association, the Irish Cattle and Sheep Farmers Association, the Irish Natura and Hill Farmers Association, the Irish Grain Growers Group, and Macmillan Pharma, so six of them in total, gathered and debated their various plans and policies as regards to predominantly the future of CAP. So I suppose, Andy, yourself and myself watched it, and indeed we've reported on it in this week's Irish Farmers Journal. I guess maybe one of the standout highlights for the tillage sector was just the various farm orgs' position on convergence. And with the exception of one, everyone had pretty much accepted a convergence rate of 85%, which is going to hammer tillage farmers' incomes.
That is for sure, Stephen. You know, if you listen to all the commentary of recent times, it's mainly targeted at the big pain being suffered by the beef sector. And unquestionably, there will be people in there who will suffer very significant pain. But, you know, the tillage sector is being hammered on all different fronts. And while convergence affects all sectors, there's nobody within the tillage sector that's going to benefit from convergence as such. In the tillage sector, we also have, in a sense, three methods of convergence. You have convergence as we understand it, which is a reduction of the entitlement values, bringing them closer to a single norm. We also have the front loading, or the CRIS as it's called, coming in, which will take money off of everybody and front load it onto about 30 hectares. So people that have lower total hectares get a net benefit from that, or people who have bigger total hectares suffer more, which is a lot of tillage farms. And then we also have the environmental proposals that are there, where you take 25% of the value of the entitlements and give them back on a flat rate basis, which is yet another form of aid, a reduction in access to aid for tillage farmers.
Yeah, so really the battle is lost here. You know, the farm orgs have accepted these three methods of convergence as such. And really it's about holding on to what we can at this stage.
Well, Stephen, it might be proper to rephrase that slightly. Those things were agreed politically despite the intervention of the farm orgs. So they don't have any choice but to accept them because they are currently part of the makeup of the new CAP. How they're implemented and what choices they will promote within the different options that are available on all three of those issues remains to be seen. And there wasn't that much of a difference in the opinions and attitudes of the different organizations last night. There were some, but you know, not a massive amount of disagreement between them on the way things would go. With the exception of the hill farmers who kind of want that everything would go to its maximum in terms of being equal for everybody.
I mean, really, look, it does play into the comments that was made last night, and that CAP, in a sense, is moved away from a production-based policy to pretty much an environmental-based policy, and that's the direction of travel.
Yeah, I think it's probably important on that one to say that, you know, CAP originally was instigated around the Treaty of Rome, which was to guarantee fair income, fair prices, and equitable living standards to the farming community of Europe. It has long since reneged on that as the general thrust of the Common Agricultural Policy. And I think that's something that we've all been aware of for some time. So the CAP has been in a continuous sense of evolution. And, you know, while we talk about the current one as being the one that's made a big difference in terms of pushing towards environment. It happened significantly in the last one as well, where greening was introduced, even though in the Irish context, tillage farmers were the only ones who really had to do anything for greening compliance. That's going to change this time around. But, you know, from a tillage perspective, greening and environmental things have been there for the past 6 years already.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I suppose some of the other points made in last Tuesday's debate, there's comments made on green diesel and also on renewables, but really there was an interesting discussion around carbon credits and the lack of clarity around the legality of who actually owns these credits generated predominantly from forestry. Initially, that was where the conversation had centred, but by default, the same also applies to carbon credits, which will be generated as such from agricultural land. I believe that the IFA have come out with a strong statement that they're taking legal advice on the matter. So really, it seems like this is only about to come to a head, you know, in the coming months.
Stephen, that's 100% right. And, you know, you and Siobhan have reported for some time about the uncertainty of whether or not carbon credits can be given to individuals at this point in time. But we have always been told that they were the carbon credits on forestry were the property of government. And I think government kind of attempted to lay their hands on them because they had supported the instigation and the afforestation to begin with. But, you know, if the support to drive a crop means that somebody else is entitled to an element of the potential income sources that are derived from it, you know, why would we sow beans? Why would we sow almost any crop? Why would we ever choose to want to increase soil carbon if the benefit that was going to accrue from it, the potential financial benefit that is, was going to accrue to government? You know, there would be no incentive there for people to do the things that are fundamentally right one way or the other. And I think the issue around what they will do on forestry is going to be significant in terms of how the farming community will work and act towards not sequestering, but taking actions to secure the storage of carbon in whatever source is possible, if the farmers themselves are not going to be the ones that will definitely accrue the benefit.
Yeah, you can really understand the anger around this as the reality of the situation begins to unfold. You know, on the forestry end of things, like I suppose forestry and farmland are really two different animals when it comes to soil carbon sequestration as such. With forestry, you can argue it's a little bit better defined. Like some of the figures I have here on sequestration potential is around 20 tonnes of CO2 per hectare per year, which is quite substantial, so it is, particularly whenever you consider that what's a tonne of carbon trading on the ETS market at the moment? Is it 70 or 80 euro? So, you know, there is a potentially large financial payout at the end of this, but it's like all these things, it's just not as simple as saying we have a hectare of forestry here and we want to sell our carbon credits. There's a lot of verification and monitoring that needs to go into this. If someone was actually to do this, never mind whether or not it's actually legal to do it, because let's remember, if this is already being counted at national level, which we believe it is, and a farmer were to, or a forestry owner were to sell their carbon credits from that said forestry, you know, that's double counting, and that farmer would be liable, as far as I see it, to the company who bought those carbon credits. So that it's going to get messy, Andy. I think it's going to get real messy in terms of the legality around this. So we'll have to watch this space.
Yeah, look, one other point that's probably worth making, Stephen, is that it was always considered that the farmer owned, when you bought land, you basically, in the eyes of the state, you owned everything in the top meter. But if minerals or oil or some other natural resource was found to be in the ground under that depth, it belonged to the state. But now we're actually talking about what's happening in the top meter. And that's where it is going to get very messy and very difficult in terms of what the definition of resources is and will be into the future.
Okay, well, we'll move on, but I have no doubt that we'll be returning to this fairly soon, I would imagine. Andy, just earlier on in this podcast, you mentioned that the premium on milling wheat, particularly in the UK, was beginning to open up. What's driving this?
Stephen, there's a number of different things. In the UK, first of all, I think if I'm remembering correctly, the premium had extended to about £36 odd over feed prices in the UK market. And they were actual figures based on the importation cost of alternatives. And in the UK context, there were two major factors in there. One was getting access to wheat that was good enough to make the standards that of the spec against which it was supplied, either to a UK miller or to an exporter or into the export market. And getting that product is proving to be very difficult because of the difficulties that existed in the UK during the UK harvest. That's understandable because that's not just confined to England. Getting access to quality wheat, whether it's grade A, grade B, grade C, whatever, premium milling, getting access to them was going to be a problem because we also had the great difficulties with caused by drought in North America, specifically in the US spring wheat area and in Canada. So there's the overall supply of that quality wheat is lower, much lower this year. But the other thing then that's after happening is that transport, albeit particularly in the UK, transport's become a big issue. Securing road transport and indeed sea transport at a price that's affordable is proving to be very difficult. So both the supply and the logistics associated with that supply are both contributing to those higher premiums in the UK. In the broader European sense, France would have been one of the major exporting countries, and it would have put a lot of wheat over the years into many parts of Europe, but in particular into North Africa. And a lot of Europe's milling wheat exports would go that route. But France has had a damnable harvest. People may remember seeing the consequences of floods, etc., through France and other areas on the continent during the harvest. And it did play a significant part in decreasing the quality of the French wheat crop, to the point that a recent report in France is suggesting that only about half the crop would pass the 240 Hagberg falling number test that has traditionally been used. And only a third of the crop would pass the 76 kph specific weight requirement used for milling. And that means that it's poorly equipped to supply a lot of the markets that it has already sold to. And that's, again, is generating a lot of problems and pressure in the market. In the past, when that happened in France, they would have imported product from other countries, mixed it with the native grain, and send it back out again, meeting the spec. But they were keeping their own French wheat in the milling and quality markets by doing that. They may or may not be able to get access to enough other wheat to do that to their own crop at this point in time. And of course, that has a small worry then in terms of where that wheat that does not make milling will end up on the feed market.
Okay, so then bringing it back home, is the economics of kickstarting our own wheat milling or milling industry here in Ireland, are they changing, or is economics, has economics been the limiting factor as to why the milling industry hasn't started up?
There was a time when we had an Irish milling industry, and in fairness, that Irish milling industry was taken over by international companies who subsequently closed it down. It wasn't a decision in the main that was made by Irish milling companies to close down. They were first bought out and then they were closed down.
And they were closed down. How long ago was that, Andy?
Oh, probably going back into the 90s, mid to late 90s, I'm guessing, Stephen. And since then, there's been no effective milling industry in Ireland, with the exception of a single mill in Port Arlington, which produces flour for the retail market. And that got a lot of publicity last year in COVID. It used to use a quantity, not necessarily a significant quantity, but a quantity of Irish wheat. And a few years ago, it stopped using Irish wheat. It uses a little bit, you know, a little bit might be between 2,000 and 5,000 tons of wheat from an opportunistic point of view. So, you know, even the wheat that's produced and sold as Irish flour to Irish housewives is originating from imported wheat in the main. And that's a real issue. So with milling premiums rising now again, it is time, I think, to have a debate. No, not a debate, probably a conversation about whether or not it is in Ireland's best interest to try and have a milling base of its own against which it may have to import some wheat. It would have to import some wheat if it was to produce industrial flour for bread making. But it certainly could produce a range of other flours for uses that would be less specific or less onerous on the Irish producer, because, you know, we have to be realistic. We cannot produce wheat in this country which will be the sole source of a sliced pan that we're used to having. You know, we cannot produce that quality of wheat in this country, and largely because our quality will always be diluted by yield, and that's just a fact of life for us. But we can produce a range of other wheat. Like, we could produce a lot more wheat that would go into the retail market if there was some form of incentive there to do that. We we've had some really, really high quality spring wheats in recent years, and some good quality winter wheats as well. But there was just no market for them, and people kind of have almost thrown in the towel in terms of having a wish to meet the requirements of that market. But now that we're looking at premia increasing everywhere, and we're looking at the uncertainties that are generated around Brexit and around all of the other things that are relating particularly to UK trade and policy, etc., and other things like that, we seriously, I think, or we have to seriously ask the question as to whether or not we should be considering putting in a milling industry in this country. I can't say that it's all going to be driven by economics, because there's a strategic element associated with this as well. So government have to be a part of it. And I think the second part of that I would like in that conversation is, if we're going to produce Irish flour from Irish wheat, what are we going to make from that? Because we know we cannot make that sliced pan. We also know that sliced pans are associated with a significant rise in the obesity in terms of the way that they're presented for children's lunches, etc., around the country. And the question is, could we move to a highly nutritious and probably somewhat healthier brown bread as an alternative? Because we could make an endless amount of flour for a brown bread market if there was kind of government policy to drive that whole element of the trade in that direction.
But is anyone looking at this? Is anyone doing it? Is anyone researching it? Is there work ongoing, or is it still at the conversational stage?
I think the problem is that it's barely at the conversational stage, Stephen. In fairness to the Irish grain growers, they had a webinar on it last year, and it was, I would have said, a very good webinar, very informative in terms of what was going on. There's one particular company, farming-based company, that is considering, or has been considering, trying to establish a mill. But you know, like anything, it's a big investment and it needs support. It needs grant aid support at the beginning, but it actually also needs support from the industry as a whole. Because at the end of the day, if they're going to continue, if the industry, as in the baking industry, is going to continue to want the cheapest source of everything that's there, well, it's not going to work for an Irish industry. You know, we have a solid base of native potential production there, but it can't be done for nothing, and it can't be done at feed wheat prices. Like, drying alone is significantly slower at harvest time than the drying of feed wheat was. And it was one of the major drivers in the past where people, individual farmers, they just got fed up trying to slow down the dryers to be able to dry milling wheat safely. And even after doing it, everything according to the book, there was going to be something wrong with the gluten when a miller came to assess the quality of it. So people just got fed up doing it, and they wanted to stop growing milling wheat at the same time.
So if you dry it too quickly or dry it at too high of a temperature, you affect the gluten levels, or you affect the quality to some degree?
You affect the quality. You affect how the dough expands in the tray as it's being baked. There are many different elements of individual varieties that affect that. And that's why flour that is used to make bread is generally made from 2, 3, or possibly even 4 different sources of wheat from different parts of the world to make what's called a grist. The grist is then ground into a flour, and that flour is what is used for different end uses. There are umpteen upon umpteen different flours produced, all produced for different end uses. Just take the simplest example that I can give you. Flour is used to make biscuits, and it's used to make bread. The flour you use to make bread, you want it to blow up and expand and get that lovely, fluffy, don't squeeze me till I'm your sliced pan. But when you put the biscuit into the tray, you want it to stay almost the same height you put it in at, because it can't rise, and if it rises, you can't fit them into the packet. So it's a completely different type of flour structure that's used in all of the different uses. Then you have pasta bases, you have buns, you've just so many different things that you can imagine. And then, of course, you have so much flour that goes into other foods that you don't see, like stuff that would go into sauces, etc., to act as thickeners and soups and all that type of stuff as well, or can go into soups. Soups now tend to have less wheat flour in them, and that's kind of useful for anybody that's celiac, where you can't afford to be ingesting gluten.
God, Andy, we could talk about this all day, but we have a podcast to finish up here. So we'll move on in the interest of time, but I know we'll be talking about this again, I suspect. So I suppose looking at the week ahead now, the Met Éireann weather forecast has just been sent in to the Irish Farmers Journal, is available in this week's paper. Bit of a dirty week ahead, have we?
Bit of a dirty week ahead, Stephen, according to the forecast as it's written now. The one thing that's kind of clear in it is that tomorrow is a wet day across the country. And I might even say, based on what Met Éireann are saying, almost an equally wet day across the whole country. So from northwest to southeast, everybody is looking at something between 10 and 14 millimetres of rain tomorrow. Now, that's a good bit of rain, but it's maybe not an awful lot of rain for the areas that are still relatively dry. And there's a lot of parts of the country that are relatively dry. There's many areas at the moment that are running at 50% of September normal rainfall levels or less. And perhaps, you know, they mightn't object to a little bit of rain. But then there's other areas that have got either more rain this week or more rain last week. And that could make trafficability of land and workability of land, it could put it on the back burner for just a little bit of time. So Thursday is the worst day. Friday is not great, except for the East Coast and the Southeast. It's down as zeros for rainfall, with some rainfall elsewhere. Unfortunately, for your part of the world, Stephen, the Northwest is given another 11 mils in the forecast. Saturday is a wet day again, but not such high levels of rain, highest of 12 in the west, 8 in the northwest, and 3s in the east and the Midlands. Sunday, you get most of the privilege on Sunday again, Stephen, but the southwest, there's an inch in the forecast for them. I think the southwest, west, and northwest have rain on the radar virtually every day for the next week. Things are a bit better in the east and southeast. Not necessarily totally dry, but a bit better. But I would always have said that where there's rain forecast for anywhere, you can't guarantee that you won't get a shower.
Very, very true.
Okay, the other thing that's noticeable, Stephen, just before we leave it, is that temperatures are way, way down. Looking at temperatures for the next week, maximum temperatures 11 to 13, with nighttime from 6 to 8. That's a big difference, and we can already begin to feel that change.
A considerable difference is right, Andy. Okay, so there we'll leave it. Time has once again beaten us. So from Andy and myself, thank you all very much for listening. Until next week, stay safe, stay tillage farming.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.